all I guess that I want is any memories, but Don Johnson suggested a little maybe higher tone, and I thought maybe you would be one for that, in terms of, you know, how the university has gone. And I was thinking as I walked over here, this library wasn't here.
No, that's right.
And so that kind of, you know, I thought,
Well, let's see. Yeah, I think, I'm trying to remember when this library opened.
What year? I couldn't.
Turn it off.
Okay.
And I'll check. Right, and I was still at Memorial Library, and that's when I was teaching, that's when I did the
Granny Square.
The Granny Square Centennial Project. And then, let's see, and then, but soon after that, I transferred over here.
Really? Okay, I didn't remember that time.
79, I transferred over here. So I think that
you were assistant to Dorothy then? Okay.
Yeah, so I think that in the 60s there was no undergraduate library separately. There was an undergraduate library in Memorial Library, and it occupied the three study halls on the Langdon Street
side.
That's
right, yeah.
And then, what you'll have to do is look up when Lou Kaplan retired, because when Lou Kaplan retired, that's the last thing that he did, is he threw the plans for building this library.
Okay.
And then he retired before it was actually finished.
Okay.
And Frank Reich was acting director, and he was acting director during the period in which the library actually opened.
Okay, I didn't remember
that. Yeah, I remember him and Dorothy talking about the difficulties they had in staffing the library, because when Lou Kaplan had the proposal, the library was supposed to, when it opened, was supposed to get something like between 12 and 15 new positions added to the library.
Mm-hmm.
And when it actually opened, they didn't get any new positions at all. And Dorothy and Rose Caruso and Mary Kay Lenanchek, who had been working at Memorial Library, opened this building by themselves.
Three people
with student assistants.
Oh my, I didn't remember this.
And then gradually, and then Joe Trace came.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually he reallocated positions from within the general library system in order to staff this library. So every position that's here has been reallocated from someplace else in the general library system.
There were the new positions.
There never were any new positions for the library.
Hmm. So. That's pretty scary. When did Dorothy leave? I was trying to remember that, too.
I have to look that date up, too. I'll look it up, and I'll look up some of these dates and send an email with them.
I just saw her down on the square at one of the last farmers markets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Didn't know anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Judy and I were together.
Yeah.
And she didn't.
It's been several years since she's been back visiting us as well. Well, most of your reminiscences were about the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's what started it with the Woodstock.
Right.
So in the 60s, you know, I was up in CTS in the third floor. And my office was sort of where Irene's is now. I was
In
the middle, overlooking the mall.
Okay.
And I was head of the processing department.
That's right, yeah.
It was before OCLC and before before we split the department into copy cataloging and
search.
And,
Yeah, because we had the depository catalog still in that area, didn't we?
Right, And the things that I remember about that time is looking out at the activities on Library Mall from that vantage point. And I have always wished that I had a decent camera at the time and had taken pictures of things. You know. But what I really remember is the involvement of the upper staff at Memorial Library. Like Frank Wright and his wife Fran, and Dorothy Schultz.
Sure.
And I remember them in the candlelight parade from Library Mall down to the Capitol at night, keeping their candles lit. And the fact that the library staff were really supportive of the student, and very active in it. And I remember one day, one of the people that works for me didn't come to work. And I found out the reason she didn't come to work was because she'd been arrested the day before, because she'd laid down in front of one of the buses that were taking the recruits off to boot camp. And
real involvement.
Yeah. And the other thing that I remember is that, you know, we did have some bomb threats. I mean, every building on campus had bomb threats. But at the time, we were getting reports from other campuses around the country about students attacking the library and seeing the library as part of the campus administration or the government or something like that. And we were getting reports back of places where they had gone in and tipped over card catalogs and poured glue all over the cards and, you know, real intense vandalism. And the library administration was very concerned about vandalism to our library as a result, which never really developed. But the interesting thing is that, again, they were planning an addition to Memorial Library during that period, that the last addition to Memorial Library, the blueprints and that sort of stuff were being planned at that time. Oh. And this was so forcibly in Lou Kaplan's mind about the possible potential damage that it influenced how that building was designed. So there are no windows, for example, on the first floor of Memorial Library.
Interesting.
And when you go into the library, you know, there are the fire doors that go into the stacks that allow free access. And those fire doors are there for fire purposes, but they were also there so that at a moment's notice, library staff could shut down access to the stacks on all floors and prevent students from going in and vandalizing the materials.
I didn't know that either.
So I mean, that was very influential the planning for the library. Yeah. But in reality, the students never really did attack the library. You know? And I remember looking out in the library mall and seeing the National Guard people on top of the State Historical Society Library and on top of the Red Gym with their submachine guns. And of course, the only other place I'd ever seen things like that was when we went down to Central America our little VW bus, and we went through Guatemala City, you know, and there were all of these military types walking around with their submachine guns, you know, and all of a sudden here it was happening in Madison. And,
pretty,
you know,
scary.
That was really scary stuff. And I remember that one day the National Guard had used tear gas in order to disperse students who were congregating around the area on campus. And so I called Peter, who was working at University Hospitals at the time. And I told him not to come to campus and pick me up, as he normally did, but to go around campus. And I would walk down to Bethel Lutheran Church on Washington Avenue and have him pick me up there. Well, he didn't understand just how agitated things were in campus, and so he came down University Avenue anyway. And then at that time, University Avenue and Johnson were both two-way. And he got stopped, and he saw that the students were out in the roads rocking the cars, trying to tip them over. So he quickly did make a right-hand turn and went over to Johnson and was able to get through okay.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing was that at the time, he looked young enough and was driving a VW bus.
So we figured
that helped a lot in terms of him getting through, because students really were quite violent at that point in time. But they never really turned against the library. The library seemed to be a sanctuary for people to run to when the tear gas was outdoors and stuff like that. You know, like, so there were a few incidents with bomb threats or the telephone. And I remember the one that someone talked about when an incendiary-looking device was found in the book drop. And what I remember, I don't know if it was the same incident or not, but I remember one in which Bill Patch had, it was found and he had it, and so to be safe, he turned one of the fire extinguishers on it, and the mess from cleaning up the foam.
Imagine.
That was the worst mess that we ever had in
the library as a result of That's funny.
Of everything that was happening.
That's funny.
It took the cleaning crew, I don't know how long, they were really disgusted.
Well, that stuff is made to stick, so. It's funny. And I don't, it's funny because I must be having selective memory because I do, I mean, I remember looking out the third floor windows and seeing the National Guard, but I, like, don't remember the phone incident at all.
Well, I remember that one. Bill came up to the third floor in order to do it. He was a mess.
Oh, no.
So they were wild times.
Now, you were head of processing until you came over here. Was this the next step? Okay.
Yeah, during the 60s, when all of this was happening, the processing department was in the middle of the center floor. And then after that, we did a reorganization, a workflow reorganization. What acquisitions had been done on the second floor.
That's right, okay.
Serials acquisitions had been done on the second floor. And there was a reorganization, and they moved up when, who was head of serial acquisitions at the time? Gordon Abrams.
Gordon Abrams, okay.
Yeah, when he resigned. They moved up to the third floor. And then we reorganized the workflow, and we had, originally, Frank Wright had been head of acquisitions, and he was on State Street, and acquisitions was on State Street. Processing was in the middle, and cataloging was on Langdon Street side.
Oh, okay.
And then we reorganized it to the way it is now, with acquisitions on the Langdon Street side, processing in the corner.
Yeah, and that's when I was there.
That's when you were there. And then cataloging from that corner all the way down to State Street.
Okay,
So in the 60s I had the front row seat.
Good spot.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any major changes? Like I think it was Ruth Sanderson said that she feels like there's been a change over time in the attitude toward working women, for example, in the library. And I think Jill mentioned that too. Do you?
Yeah.
I always felt like working women were respected from the day one, really, so.
Well, there was definitely, when I first came, there was a different attitude in society in general.
True.
And so it was expected, for example, that when women became pregnant, that they were going to quit and stay home with their family. And so the library was very reluctant, for example, to grant maternity leaves.
Oh, okay.
Because it meant a disruption of the workflow, and it meant hiring someone on a temporary basis to train them while someone was off on maternity leave, and then having to give the job back to someone who would not know the changes that were made in the interim. And so when I first started, and this was in the early 60s, things like that were discouraged. Maternity leave was definitely discouraged. I think that women as a whole were respected within the library. The heads of several departments, like the head of cataloging was a woman at the time, and the head of reference, Marge Christensen, was highly respected by everyone at the time. I think that Lloyd Griffin was in charge of the bibliographers, and Bill Hatch was not in charge of circulation when I came. A woman, Ethel Lyman.
Oh, Lois mentioned.
Was in charge of circulation when I first came,
okay,
and then Bill Hatch became head of circulation after her. So, although it is true that the director of the library and the two associate directors were males, Lou Kaplan, Frank Wright, and Gary Nesset, below that level, it was predominantly women. And I think there's always been a balance between men and women in the positions. So I didn't think that the contributions of women were not respected, but in terms of other things, and as I say, it's been a change in society. The hierarchy was very much the mode of operation, university-wide, in
sure.
business and everything at the
right.
time, and it was in the library as well. Things that Don Johnson does not want to put in the newsletter because there's been too much of that, but I remember the buzzer for breaks.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the
yes,
buzzer for breaks?
Definitely.
You had to go at your scheduled time, and when the buzzer rang in the break
leave.
Room, you had to leave, yes. But you know, that was part of the era that Lou Kaplan grew up in and administered. And the minute he left and Joe Trace came in, that all went out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was exactly what you're saying, more uh-huh. a generational thing
than
anything else.
Right. That all disappeared overnight, all of that sort of
kind of thinking, yeah.
Yeah, weird dress codes.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, not the matching pants suits.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and that changed very quickly. And I think that there's been a continual growth in the total involvement of library staff and decision making
mm-hmm.
and participatory management and that sort of thing. It's been an evolutionary thing, obviously. You don't go from a very strictly hierarchy to full-blown self-directed teams
mm-hmm.
overnight. It's been an evolving thing, but I think that the library has been on the forefront of that evolution on campus.
I agree with you.
And in terms of fair hiring practices for academic staff, search and screen committees, and equity action monitors and all this sort
mm-hmm.
of thing, I think that the library has been way out ahead of other hiring units on
and
campus.
Even things like indefinite appointment and
mm-hmm.
that, we're
yeah.
always viewed as a leader.
Exactly, yeah. That search and screen process that we have, I've been, you know, there are some things, when you've been in the library as long as I have, you know, I consider myself Mother NLS because I was on that development team
That's
for the
right,
NLS, you
yeah.
know. And one of the other things that I did that, you know, you start these things and then you sit back years later and you look at it and you say, oh my God.
It's my fault.
It's all my fault, yeah. Well,
Search and screen?
Search and screen,
that
yeah.
sounds like.
At the, in the 60s when the college library was opening, Dorothy was over here, but I was still in the processing department at Memorial Library. And Joe Trace was the director, and there was a lot of minorities and equity and hiring and that sort of stuff. And Joe appointed an affirmative action committee, I think that's what it was called, equal opportunity committee, something like
mm-hmm.
that, okay. And I was not the first chair. I think Rose Caruso was the first chair, and she chaired it for a couple of years. And then Joe asked me to chair.
Mm.
And during the period in which I was chairing it, we had an incident. We had a search and screen and hiring in which faculty were involved. It was for a bibliographer position. And because it was that type of position, the candidates, the faculty department was given an opportunity to interview the candidates. And one of the candidates, a woman, was very upset with the treatment that she received. From the faculty.
From the faculty.
Not from the library, but from the faculty group.
Mm.
And she threatened lawsuits and all sorts of things as a result of it. Nothing really developed. The library apologized or whatever, and she did not pursue. But there was real concern raised in the library administration about our search and screen procedures. And so as chair of the committee, I was asked to develop a document for for search and screen procedures,
oh,
which now is something like 35 pages long, but it was myself, Frank Bright, and Janine Tuberville, and someone called, was Linda Alexander on it? I don't know. I can't remember everyone that was on the committee, as a matter of fact. But we were charged with writing some search and screen procedures. So I remember Janine because we said, where do we start? And so Janine said she would do a literature search for us and find out what was out there. So she did. She came up with a big fat zero.
Oh, you're kidding.
Honest to God.
So we really were pioneers.
And so we said, okay, we're fair, equitable, sensitive people. So we sat down and we wrote some search and screen guidelines, and then we took it to various groups around the library, and we took it to the member librarians, I remember, and talked about it and got approval and instituted the first search and screen guidelines. But in terms of being the leaders, okay, I mean, we could not find any other library that had search and screen committees with equity action monitors and with policies that you had to follow in terms of how, you know, how to handle the candidates and everything like that. I mean, people were still moving in the libraries. Most hiring was still done by that. By the supervisor. It was a one person who would screen
make
the applications,
decision.
Make a decision, and hire. And we were the forefront in that. And we were the forefront in the campus as well, because in other departments that's what they were doing as well. And the idea of having a committee made up of peers with the supervisor there, but the committee was made up of peers recommending, interviewing, and making not the final decision, because the final decision is always with the director of libraries, but the...
A solid recommendation or whatever.
I mean, you know, in our libraries, it's mostly been whatever the committee has recommended has been what has happened.
That's neat.
So, and then I was another analyst. I have to tell you, my first job in the library as a student assistant was a precursor for my career. My first job was a computer job in
the
library.
The cards?
With the punch cards. Yes, indeed. I was hired, the library administration, Lou Kaplan and Frank Bright primarily, had made the decision, and who was the head of cataloging at the time? Irene Doyle, maybe? I can't remember. That was her name right now. Anyway, they had made the decision to switch from the Dewey, from the cutter system to LC about 2 to 3 years prior. And so they had started cataloging, and they had, you know, like a row of books in LC, and the rest of the library was all in cutter. And they got money from campus to do a reclassification project to reclassify the high-use cutter books into LC. So the prior summer to when I came, they hired a crew of student assistants who sat down with the shelf list and filled out a punch card for every card in the shelf list with the call number. And then when I came in the fall, my job, along with a whole bunch of other people, Milman Nessa was in charge of it. My job was to take these boxes of IBM cards and go into the stacks, and I had to find the matching volume for the card, open it up, look at the date due slip, count how many times it had circulated within the past 5 years, and make a little pencil mark on the IBM punch card.
No.
Yeah, and I spent, that was my first student assistant job, and I spent the fall and the spring semester doing that. And then, did I do that for 2 years? I might have done that for 2 years, as a matter of fact, because...
And you still went to library school?
Yeah, because then there was a summer in which I stayed on campus. And I can't remember if it was the summer between my junior and senior year or between my senior year in library school. But anyway, one of those summers, I stayed on campus, and so I worked full-time in a student job at the library. And my job was in the basement of some building on campus, and I don't remember which one. There was a card sorter. And my job for that summer was to feed these cards through the machine so that it would sort them so that the ones that circulated the most would come up on the top of the deck. Yes.
Well, see, it was the precursor.
That was my first job. And then using those cards, I worked on the reclassification team. And it was student assistants. We got the books, pulled all of the cards from the card catalog.
Oh, yeah, you have
for
to
the book.
Pull the whole set.
Yes, I got to pull cards. And then there was a crew of student assistants who used electric erasers, and they erased the call number that was typed in the card. And then another crew of student assistants typed the new LC number on. And then the book was pulled and matched with the cards and remarked. And then the cards were refiled, and the book was reshelved in the new LC.
Do you know if they had, I'm just interested, because I didn't realize you did that. Did they have a conversion table from Cutter to LC, or did catalogers examine each piece?
Well, that was another one of my jobs. For they had been using LC cards for a number of years.
Oh, so the number was right there.
So the number was right on the
sure.
card, and they used that one. And
okay.
someone, I don't know, there must have been a student assistant, it wasn't me. I don't know if they verified it against the shelf list or not. The shelf list was so small.
I'm sure
that
at that point it probably
didn't
need to.
It
didn't
really make much difference, yeah. But they may have. But then, after I graduated from pulling cards, my next job was for cards that had been produced in the library without the LC number on them. I spent, I don't know how, a semester, I don't know how many hours, searching the National Union catalog looking at the call numbers for those that I could find. And then if I couldn't, and I'm sure that there were more students working on it besides mm-hmm. me, but, and then for the ones that we couldn't find the call numbers, then they went to an original cataloger who classified them.
Okay.
So it was a mammoth project.
Oh, had to be, yeah. Amazing. So you worked there quite a few years as a student, then, at least
3 years.
Or three?
No, yeah. 2 years. Only 2 years. So, yeah. So it must have been between my my junior and senior year that I sorted the cards, because in my senior year, then, I worked on the reclassification project. Hmm. And then when I went to library school, that was another one of my first. I was the first library trainee.
Oh.
At the time in the 60s, I mean, people graduated from library school now and died to know, but at that time in the 60s, when you graduated from library school, they were standing in line offering you jobs. There was a shortage of librarians like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. And Memorial Library was having the problems as well, so they decided one of the things they needed to do was to train some of their own. So they developed this library trainee program, in which I worked half-time at the library at regular wages, not student assistant wages, but in a regular appointment, and that enabled me to pay my way through library school.
Okay.
I went to library school.
Now we've talked, what goes around comes around, we've mm-hmm. talked about that in the Cultural Diversity Committee, to try to do something like that, and Ken is in fact all in favor mm-hmm. of it, to attract someone of color or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, to come
right.
and go to library school. Interesting.
Yeah. So it worked out quite well. At the time, the library school was where the humanities building is now. It was in a women's sorority house right across the street over there. Yeah. Down the alley, right behind the university club.
Huh.
On the other side. And it was dismantled when the humanities. And then, you know, it moved out to
Henry
Mall.
Because that's where I took some
building.
Courses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
with Miss Monroe at Henry Mall. Yeah.
So while I went to library school, I worked as a trainee. And then when I graduated from library school, I got married and we decided to stay in Madison. And so they just hired me, period.
Happy
as I say,
to have you, I'm
happy
sure.
to have you. They were oh, happy to have anyone
yeah.
at the time. Yeah. at the time, I actually did interview from some other places. At that time, recruiters came to campus from other libraries to try to persuade you to come to their library.
Yes.
And so I did go through some of those. I remember that I interviewed for the Detroit Public Library because Peter was interested in a job in Detroit. Thank God he didn't want it.
Really?
And I can't remember where else, but I interviewed from a number of libraries that sent recruiters to campus.
Here?
And they set up a day of recruitment, and they would talk to anyone who would talk to them. And just about every single one of the people that I talked to offered me a position. I mean, wherever Peter had wanted to locate in this country, I knew I did not have any problem at all. I told them, I'll go wherever you want. And when I get to that city, I will walk into the nearest library and I will say, here I am. And they will say, wonderful. Which of their jobs do you want?
Different times.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, they were so desperate that they weren't even, you know, they had, like in their civil service, for some of the public libraries, they were not offering entry-level jobs at the entry-level salaries anymore. They were offering them at the mid-range,
just to get people.
To attract librarians. Mm-hmm. So I stayed here, though, and I've been very, very happy. Was a good decision for me. I really enjoyed it. So do you want to know about Mother MLS? What do you all want to know about?
Sure. That sounds good. I remember writing you at one point you sent out not an email, but a memo saying, any ideas that you have, send them to me, and I sent you something.
Well, that was after I had moved over here to College Library.
Okay.
And yeah. I was the assistant director then, and Dorothy Schultz was the director of the library. And Joe Trays had made connections with the University of Chicago, who was interested in developing they already had a library computer system. They were interested in developing it further, and they wanted to seek grant funding for it. And Joe also was very interested in automation, mm-hmm. and he wanted to develop something on this campus as well, and Frank Bright also was very interested in mm-hmm. Primary mover and library automation. At the time, we had the punch card reserve book room system, and they were creating the serial print catalog.
Oh, yeah.
But there was nothing online. Mm-hmm. And the Chicago system, like the Northwestern system, was a punch card system as well. And Chicago was interested in developing an online system. And so the first thing that they decided that they wanted to develop was a circulation system. Jim Muhlenberg.
I'm going to say, I just wanted to be sure. I thought, oh, no.
Jim Muhlenberg, I think, was working, and one of the projects, either the reserve system or the serial catalog system, I don't know. He was a programmer for ADP. And they tapped into him, and he came over to the library and interviewed me on what was needed in the circulation system. Because we had the reserve circulation system over here, which was the punch
card
system.
So it made sense, yeah.
So I talked with him about that, and as a consequence, found out from him that the library was interested in this project. So I was very interested in it, and I wanted to be involved in the project. So I went to Joe Trays and told him that if he was developing a library team of any sort to work on a computer project, that I would like to be involved in it. Of course, I knew nothing about computers. I'd never used a computer. I'd never taken a computer course or anything about it, but it really intrigued me.
You knew it was,
I knew it was
the way to go.
Yeah, right. They fascinated me. I'd been to a few conferences and seen some demonstrations of computer systems and thought we ought to have one here. So I asked him to be put on any team that was developed. So along the way then, ADP in the library in the University of Chicago applied to IBM for a grant and received the money to develop it. And Joe did ask me then to work on the project. And so I was the library liaison. That was my title.
Okay.
And I started working with the team, and the first thing, and then there were people from the University of Chicago as well, librarians as well as programmers. And I started working with the team, and the first thing I realized was that I didn't know from near enough about circulation to write these specifications. And so I went over, and Judy Tuttle was head of circulation by then at Memorial Library. Mm. So I went over and I twisted Judy Tuttle's arm and I told her that she really wanted to be on this project, and she said, absolutely not. And I said, but yes, you really do. And she said, absolutely not. And I said, Judy, it's not going to take much of your time at all. All we need is your expertise. So she relented and she agreed to work on the project. She never failed to remind me about it for years thereafter as it started consuming her life. And then the other thing that I did was tried to develop a committee that would be like a focus group committee. Mm-hmm. We didn't use those words at that time, but a reactionary committee for me, because I was the liaison between the library, what the library wanted, and the programmers who were programming it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I tried to develop a library committee, and I'll never forget it. No one was interested. No one. I mean, Frank Bright was interested. He was on the committee immediately. I could not get anyone else to serve on the committee. The only other person who would take me up was Dennis Hill. He was enthusiastic, and he agreed to work on the committee. No one in reference at the time would work on the committee. And I don't think that there was anyone else there. There must have been someone there from CTS. I don't remember who it was, besides Frank. Maybe there wasn't anyone else. I remember that Nancy Paul graciously agreed to be on it from the law library. She wasn't too happy about it, but she agreed. And so it was a very small group. There may have been someone else, but everyone in the library was just totally uninterested in this and did not want to waste their time working on it. But so I proceeded to do my best and to write the specifications. And then I began working with the programmers. And it came to the point in time then when we started developing the system. And we were doing it in consultation with the University of Chicago people.
Okay.
That meant that we had to work together very closely. So this is when Judy really started reminding me that I told her it wouldn't take much time. Because we ended up spending 2 days a week. We would leave, we traded going to Chicago and them coming here. So our team, which was Judy and myself and Jim Muhlenberg and Mark Foster, would leave here in a fleet car at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning. We'd drive down to Chicago, get there about noon to the library. We'd work all afternoon. Take a break for supper, go back and work to 10 o'clock at night, catch some sleep, back to the University of Chicago Library 8 o'clock or earlier the next day on Friday, work to about noon to 2 o'clock, and then drive back home to Madison. And then the following weekend they would do it and they would come here, and then we would go there. And every other weekend, all year round, I remember blinding snowstorms driving to Chicago with the snow just, you know, in the windshield.
I didn't know you guys.
And on the way back home, yeah.
Amazing.
And we did that for something like 2 years in order to develop the system.
Now, Jim Muhlenberg went to library school, or took courses, didn't he? Because I remember seeing him.
I think so.
And I think that was when I was taking courses.
Yeah, he never got a degree. But I think that he did
just
take
to get
some courses
more of a
in
feel
order
for
to
it.
Learn more about libraries.
Yeah, because I always thought that was admirable. I mean, I remember, you know.
Yeah. And of course, Mark Foster was a natural.
It
was just, it was the ideal thing for him. With his interest in books and his interest in news books and the whole thing, you know, he just was excellent in terms of understanding the library and developing them. Then they got the Series 1, and their team grew, and they got a special NLS house that only housed the people working on the project. And they got a Series 1 microcomputer in order to develop the catalog and the circulation system. And at that point, my job was to break it. Okay, so they would program something, and then when they had it working, then I would go over there, and I would try and break it.
Oh, that's fun.
I would do everything I could think of in order to find out where the bugs were in the system.
Were there programmers from Chicago involved too, or did it fall to, it didn't completely fall to ADP
staff? No, initially there were programmers in both places.
Okay.
For the first, what I think it was a 4-year project, and then, was it 2 or 4 years? I don't know, but at some point then, Chicago pulled back and we went on our own.
Okay.
And finished the development on our own. But the development did not finish until actually Kay was here. The final ceremony marking the end of the last IBM grant and the spewing forth into the world of NLS was when Kay was here.
Okay, okay.
She had just arrived. So Nancy Marshall finished it up, and then Kay came just as the grant ran out, and we had the final party and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a long period.
Yeah, really. I didn't realize that you guys did that for 2 years. I knew, I've heard from Judy that you did it, but not that long. Whoa.
And in the course of that, of course, then Dorothy retired and I moved from being assistant director to director of the library. And I was still working on that project.
Jeez, that's amazing.
So I did not stop working on that project until Kay came. And then one thing that Nancy did is, as we moved into implementation, then we realized that we needed a full-time automation person on the library staff, because up until then we didn't have anyone with any automation experience on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Nancy asked me, you know, what did I want to do? Did I want to be director of college library, or did I want that job? I said I wanted to be director of college library. So we had a search and screen committee, because I was acting all that time as director of college library. There was the search and screen committee, and they hired me as director of the library. And then I told Nancy the key thing I wanted to do was I wanted to chair the search and screen committee to select an automation person.
Hmm.
Because by then I had developed quite a few contacts, and I sort of knew who was out in the field and who I thought was good and who mm-hmm. I thought spoke better than they delivered. And so I chaired the committee, and we went through an aborted search. We didn't find anyone. And then that was the point then in which Nancy realized that she was not going to get the job as director, which she had been hoping for. And because they were at the finalists in the interview at that stage, and Nancy was not a finalist for the interviews.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so Nancy canceled the search at that point in time and said, we're not satisfied with any of the candidates. It would be inappropriate for me to move ahead at this point in time.
That's
so
good.
She canceled it. And then Kay came and we appointed a new search. And this time we took a much more aggressive approach. And we actually did some arm twisting in terms of people to interview. And one of the arms we twisted was Nolan. And I said, yeah, Nolan is the one we wanted. I had worked with Nolan.
Hmm.
Some of the ALA committees that
uh-huh.
I was on, and I had very high opinion of him. So we went through the search then, and then Kay twisted my arm, which was one of the best mm-hmm. things I've ever done, as far
yeah,
as I'm
really.
Concerned. So then he came and he took over after that, and then I stopped working with the project completely. And I think the only thing I did for a while is I chaired the public catalog review group as we continued developing the NLS public catalog side of it. I chaired that for a while and then pulled out of that as well.
Hmm.
There comes a point in time when you feel that you're more of a hindrance to new ideas coming along than you are a help. And I decided it was time to pull out.
But, I mean, you had this other job.
Yeah,
going
I did.
On.
Yeah.
Judy and I just went out and visited Nancy.
Oh, really?
Geez, when was it now? Early November, mid November. It was fun. She took off work even.
Well, I think that has been a good move for Nancy.
Oh,
I think she's really
absolutely.
Enjoyed that job there.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. I think it was just what they needed it and what she needed. It was one of the win-win things.
I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Well, that's neat. I didn't know. All, either I didn't know or I didn't remember. Partially, maybe I didn't remember, but I bet I didn't know. Because, what you know, everybody didn't know.
Right.
I mean, and I was just one of the everybodies. And I wasn't even here during part of that time.
That's right.
Part yeah. of it, I was in Virginia.
It's been an exciting period.
It has. Frank Grisham, who is head of Solonet Network, just retired last year, and at his final OCLC Users Council meeting, he said,
OCLC first came in 1976, and everything was virtually manual before then. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is true that we had that reserve acquisitions punch card system, which was supposed to, at one time, be a prototype of a library system. But it was still a very manual system with all that key punching and folding like that. And when OCLC came in, it was the first move to automation. And it was really, really scary. And people really were worried about whether they would be able to learn the OCLC, et cetera. And so we set up volunteer OCLC. No one was required to learn OCLC. We set up a voluntary task force of people who were willing to learn it and to see what we could do with it. And
Gene Larson and I were both on that, I remember.
Right.
And it was, I mean, I thought it was so neat. It was just the ticket. But a lot of people didn't.
And that's when we did the granny squares because I mean that was high tech, high touch, and we didn't even realize it because people were really scared about the technology and that sort of stuff, you know. So during lunch hour, we went to granny squares and we did some fun things, and everyone learned how to do granny squares.
Yes, good point. Yeah, I mean, we didn't even know that
the theory
we were doing
it,
this right thing.
Yeah, but it worked, you know. And then soon after OCLC came in, that's when Joe Trey's reorganized things. And I moved over here, and Sandy Fahler.
Oh, yeah.
Processing and copy cataloging was combined together. And Sandy Fahler became in charge of that. And then she's the one that actually, we'll have to talk with her about that. She's the one then that actually, that gradually pulled people in and trained them on a one-to-one basis to use OCLC until finally everybody was. But it was really scary. And now when you think about how automated we are, and how
some of
email,
those very same people are.
Yeah, if email is down or your computer's not working, you're out of a job. There's nothing you can do.
We CTS management sits and makes lists of things to do when there are problems, and it's hard. It's getting harder and harder
to find anything.
Yeah,
to do, right.
I mean, really.
I mean, basically, what can you do? Pull
I mean,
cards
can
from
do
the
make work, yeah,
from
pull
the catalog,
from the public or
shrink
something.
The catalog and stuff like that. But there is nothing else you can do.
It's
and you know, if email's not functioning, it's like I can't write a memo anymore.
I know.
And at one point, what happened? Oh, one point, when I still had the PC. I reformatted my hard drive by mistake. I put a floppy disk in, and I was going to format the floppy disk. And so I put it in,
but
and I issued the command, and it said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And instead of changing it to A drive, I left it on C drive.
Oh, man.
And it reformatted my hard disk for me. And luckily, I had remembered when Frank Bright had done that.
So you had backups.
And so I had backups. And so the automation desk was able to come over, and they reloaded the whole thing for me, and I actually didn't lose anything. But during that 48 hours between the time that they came over and got it all working for me, and it went down and it was working for me again. It was like I couldn't even think.
Yeah, I mean, it's like brain freeze or something.
I kept on thinking of things for me to do, you know, and I was all caught up in my filing, and I had my desk cleaned up. I mean, write something on paper and pencil? No. I can't do that. I need a computer to write, you know. It was the most scary experience.
Pretty weird. You're right. So what, when you retire, are you going to continue using a computer for everything? I mean, I think about that.
I have a computer at home.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't do library work on it for the most part. Every once in a while,
I do email sometimes, but
yeah, I don't. I refuse to hook mine up for email at home because I know that that just
it'd be
gobble up too much of my time. But I do take things home on the disk every once in a while. But yeah, I've got a Macintosh, so I've got my recipe files, and I have my Glacier Flower Books file, and I've got my Garden Flowers file. I've got all sorts of things on the computer. And I do write letters and stuff on the
computer.
Lloyd
has gotten into that. I'm so proud of him. He just thinks it's cool. And I said I wrote little instructions, and it goes to large print, and that's the neatest part of all. So he's writing to his brother all the time now. Yeah, you're right. It's kind of a scary change, but it's
and
a complete
one. The interesting thing is that library administrators originally saw the greatest potential for library administration being in the public service side. And they wanted to immediately do circulation and create an online catalog. And you know that initially, when commercial library systems were available, that's all that library administrators wanted was an online catalog that would be linked up to their circulation system somehow. But in actuality, in Memorial Library, we did develop the online catalog. We did develop a circulation system that was only used at College Library, and then we scrapped it and went to the notice system.
Yeah.
So we did develop the online catalog, but then we concentrated for a number of years in technical services because we realized that we really needed the base. That without the base records, there wasn't much that you could do.
Well, that's what Frank always said. You know, our gift to the library is the database, and they've got to have that to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I quote him a lot on that one.
So we brought up cataloging, and then we brought up acquisitions and serial check-in, and we brought up, you know, all of those modules first before we actually saw any real significant changes in the public service area, you know.
We did that at Durham, too. I was hired to institute Dynex there, and we brought up cataloging first.
Right.
Okay.
And we ran the online catalog in the card catalog duo for many years. It was until after Kay came, and we had all of these technical services things in place that we started really putting microcomputers out in the member libraries. And it was, I can't remember when she came, but I remember that when we had the, after she came, she reorganized because we had that budget crunch.
Oh yeah,
and
that's right.
College Library closed for a summer because of the asbestos removal
and
the upper parking, and that was the time that we were reorganizing. And when we opened after that, we moved the computers down to the first floor as part of the College Library reorganization and left the card catalog abandoned up on the second floor. And we left it up there for about a year, and then we finally got rid of it. But we still reference continued to be, except for the online catalog, continued to be a manual process.
Yeah.
Until Ken came.
Until very recently, really.
The first standalone CD-ROMs was right before Ken came. Memorial got some, and we got some. And Steenbach was experimenting with putting up their land, their internal Steenbach-only land. And engineering was starting to experiment with putting up their land. But then after Ken became director, that's when we first put up the campus-wide land. And that has been the thing that has dramatically changed the way we do efforts. But that really has only been for the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, you're right, and that's amazing to think of it in those terms, too, that it is that recent, because it really has changed the way things are done.
And has been the most significant impact on the public services. Mm-hmm. And that's had a much more significant impact than the online camera. And I think that there's been an attitude change in faculty in terms of electronic resources since we have brought up the databases.
All the other stuff, sure. Because it means more. Well,
yeah.
You know.
There was strong resistance to the computerization of the card catalog. And faculty thought it was a mistake, and they couldn't see any benefit from it. They felt it was just a lot of wasted money, that the card catalog served as well for years, and they could not see any benefits from all of this fancy searching. What do you need fancy searching for? You look up the author's name in the card catalog, you find that if we have the book or not. So what needs to be fancy mm-hmm. about it, you know? And as part of my job as the NLS liaison, I had to do demonstrations. I did demonstrations all over the place. I did demonstrations to the university administration, and demonstrations to Florida, to other libraries, and demonstrations to faculty. And the worst group to demonstrate to were faculty, because they just were opposed to it. The best that any of them would say is, I remember Nancy was here at the time, a faculty person saying, "It's okay, but Nancy, please don't take away our card catalog." I mean, I know it's coming, but not too soon. I mean, some were just adamant against it. They were very, very opposed, violently opposed to it. And the best reaction we could get for faculty was, "I know the pathetic, I know it's coming, but please not too soon. Don't do it while I still care."
But and the journals, but the I attitude, mean, that's their lifeblood.
Mm-hmm, the attitude towards library automation, electronic information, is really changing now that they're starting to use, the databases, the citation databases, they're starting to use the internet, and they're starting to use full text things. And there's a much more welcoming. The journal collection is still paramount in the minds of a lot of faculty, particularly the science. And the book collection is still our treasure in terms mm-hmm. of the humanities and social science scholars. But there is more of a willingness to use the electronic products than there was to use the online catalog.
Yeah.
So there's still a long way to go.
I think part of that too might be generational a bit, but I think you're right, the mm-hmm. difference is more the journal versus the bibliographic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the access from their offices.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very
the networking.
Important.
Yeah.
The networking, right?
Yeah.
The
that's
fact
true.
That they
then they can see a real big advantage.
Right. And NLS was available in their offices, but not enough faculty had computers at the time.
Yeah, so part of it was just mm-hmm. a timing thing too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
They still had to come to the library, and if they were coming to the library they might as well use the card catalog.
Good point.
But now that computers are more prevalent in faculty offices, mm-hmm. more people are using it for email and for processing and other things, there's more of a willingness to try out things.
I know, I just went to the History of Cartography project, trying to work with them on using First Search, and she said too that it was like a revolutionary moment when they could access things from their office
mm-hmm.
instead of having to mm-hmm. walk over to Memorial, which is, you know, half a block.
Right.
But still, she said it really, that was like
yep.
a line, and I think that does make a huge difference.
that it's one of the things we're doing now in College Library as a reference review, using that teaching and process. And one of the things you do in TQM is you flowchart the process.
Mm-hmm.
So we flowcharted the reference process. And it's really interesting to see how the electronic products have changed their process.
I bet.
And it's more than cosmetic. It's more than you used to look in a book and now you're looking at that place. It really has changed their process.
The whole process.
Significantly in a way that the online catalog never ever did.
Hmm.
So new and better things to come along that line.
Especially and this full text and
the
total electronic library is really amazing.
So in that respect, you know, your guy that said, you know, he would like to be starting out now. In my mind, now is really the beginning. All of this that has gone before is really building up to what's going to come in the next 5 to 10 years. And one of the things that I saw in email, I can't remember which list, but a survey was done in Great Britain in which libraries, like the equivalent of our ARL libraries,
mm-hmm.
research libraries, were asked, how long do you think it will be before you have a totally electronic library, before 90% of your journal subscriptions are in electronic form rather than print form?
Okay.
And they got a wide range of responses, but the majority of the responses fell in the 8 to 10 years. 8 to 10 years,
90%
of their journals will be in electronic form rather than print form.
You could be right.
And so I say to myself, boy, we got a lot of work to do in the next 5 years to be ready for that.
We've got to expand the capacity so email doesn't clunk down every... I mean, really, that is one of the... Richard and Jeannie and I were talking about that. I mean, every university's facing it, just this overuse mm-hmm. of now limited mm-hmm. networks and systems. Because you've got your email, you've got your Chronos, you've got your online catalog, you've got your databases.
Yeah. One of the things I talk about with people, it's hard for them to relate, but I think that you can relate to it better than particularly some of our newer staff. When we first got OCLC in 76 or thereabouts, okay, I remember that this was very important to Frank Bright, and he set up all of these procedures and policies on how exactly those records in OCLC were to be formatted and exactly what was supposed to be done with them, because there was an archive tape that came monthly
mm-hmm.
to Wills, okay? Well, over the years, as people worked with him, the people and CTS who are actually using OCLC saw OCLC as a card production facility. It was an efficient way to produce catalog cards
mm-hmm.
rather than typing them or any other method, okay? And so they started modifying these policies and stuff that Frank had set up in order to produce catalog cards efficiently and effectively with the least amount of staff time. And Frank didn't realize this. And when we came then to load those records into the online catalog, we suddenly discovered that only Frank and a few other people, but mostly Frank, had a vision of all of the years that we were creating those OCLC archive tapes. We were not producing catalog cards. We were creating a database. But the people who were actually doing it did not have that vision.
Mm-hmm.
They did not see a database, an online catalog that was meaningless to them.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
So when we came to load the records, we suddenly discovered that we had a mess. Instead of this clear, clean database that Frank thought we had
the
on those
policy.
Archive tapes, okay, we had a big mess. And so Mark Foster spent a lot of programming time cleaning up the database as much as he could, and then we have spent a lot of staff time since then manually cleaning up the catalog in order to
mm-hmm.
go back and compensate for the fact that people were producing catalog cards. They did not have the vision of the online catalog in the database. And I think that that's where we are right now in terms of electronic information, that all of what we have done so far is building up to something.
Mm-hmm.
And what is not clear in people's minds is the vision of where we're going to, so that we can make a beeline path to that and not produce catalog cards.
Uh-huh.
And that, I think, is the crucial point that we're at right now in the library profession.
And we the are challenge
at
of
a turning point. Yes, just as Frank saw that he was at a turning point when we started with OCLC. We are at another major turning mm-hmm. point. And where we go is going to be very critical. And how to see that vision as something that is really our major responsibility right now in the library profession.
But I think it is telling what you quoted about the majority of libraries feeling that this was going to happen, 90% of their journals within 8 to 10 years. So there is, I think, now more of an ability to have that mm-hmm. vision.
But this was Great Britain.
Yeah, well.
This was not the United States.
Not Iowa, huh?
I wonder
what would
happen
be said here. That's a good question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if we ask faculty.
True. Oh, well.
So now we're talking about the future, and we were supposed to talk about the past.
The past. Well, we got
we've sort
got
of on the two together,
through
yeah.
the spectrum. Okay. I was supposed to ask about Linda, how Linda's doing.
Linda is doing fine. She